Well, Sonika, we're going to talk about dwelling in the secret place. And the question is, why did you even write it? But we'll come to that. And you wrote rather personally about your own life and how you see these things. And, well, let's say we opened up our soul a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you started off with your childhood, and you wrote it very carefully. And the idea in this whole book was not to accuse people, but just to tell a story. And to also try and bring across how God changes people, and that the road, just like in Bunyan's book,
mm-hmm.
is not always an easy one, eh? It's not always an easy road. And some people might think, well, if it's so hard, then I'm going to give up. And especially if those that you think will treat you in a Christian way don't always do that, some people might think, well, why do you take it? Why don't you just leave? And I think you get to the point then where Jesus was when he spoke to all of those people, and they said, this is a hard teaching, who can bear it? And many of them turned and left him. And he turned to his disciples and he said, do you also want to go? And Peter said, where shall we go, Lord? You have the words of eternal life. And this is one of those situations. So the book, I don't think, was written from the departure point of exposing things that go wrong, but rather wanting to encourage people to hang in there, even if it does go wrong.
And God uses situations, even if you're not even a Christian yet. I think he used both of us and to go through these experiences so that when we get to a point where we have to accept truth and there's so much opposition and the enemy is so angry, that you will be able to deal with it. Because if you haven't been through trials and things, you will not become stronger.
Correct.
So, yeah.
Now, you state in your book that biting the hand that feeds you is one of the components. So why did you write that?
Well, when you're young, you're innocent, and you think everything is beautiful. You don't realize that there's an enemy. You don't realize that there's danger. And that's why God also says in the Bible, he says, lest you become like little children, you cannot see the kingdom of heaven. So you need to be innocent in that way, but it will bite you if you don't understand that there's an enemy, and that you will one day, somebody will hurt you, and that, you know, you will be.
So you started your story and the life story with the hand, biting the hand that feeds you. You're trying to help someone and it backfires on you.
In your whole life, you're learning step by step that you have to be very careful whom you trust and what the enemy has in store for you.
Yes, it's a very, very intricate situation, and particularly because people are involved. You don't want to hurt people, but you want to bring across certain concepts.
Mm-hmm.
And so you change the names of the people so that, well, I guess if they read it, they can probably recognize themselves.
Yes, but the purpose of the book was not to, as you said, accuse people. It was to show how God uses people to shape us.
Yes.
And to mold us.
And even if you are not a believer, God creates circumstances that make you ask questions, and God creates circumstances that bring you to the point where you might make decisions. And anybody that looks at this world will say, this world is a very unfair place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very painful place very often. It has its ups and it has its downs. It has its joys and it has its sorrows. But you are shaped by your environment.
Yes. And I believe, and I don't know if it's really true, but I believe God already shaped us before we were Christians. He brought us through all these trials with your background, my background. And he actually, I think he planned us to be together because it doesn't just happen by chance.
Nothing happens by chance. It's either providence
mm-hmm.
or something that you cannot define. Now, we know there's an enemy. Now, when we were still in the heathen world, and you came out of this occult background, and I came out of this religious conflict background that eventually led me to atheism, then you ask yourself the question, was God there from the beginning? Were the angels involved in our lives? Did the devil watch the situation? Does he watch people? And does he draw conclusions, perhaps, by what is happening behind the scenes that we cannot see? And does he target some people more than others?
Mm-hmm.
These are questions that pop up in the mind.
Every person has an angel watching over him. So I assume that Satan knows something that we can't see.
He assumes something.
He assumes something, yes.
Now, you tell in your story, you say that you were the only child that didn't go to church on Sundays. And I know why, because your parents had a major problem with the churches. They were into occultism, or your father in particular.
Yeah, and my mother was raised in a Christian home, and she wasn't very comfortable with a Christian lifestyle. And so she went into the world, and anything goes when you're in the world. You know, you accept anything. And my father, the same thing. He was also raised very strictly as a Christian. But the two of them decided they would explore anything else but the Bible. And so
your father actually did explore the Bible,
but he
explored it from another angle.
Yes, he believed that everything is misinterpreted in the Bible, and that there's a lot of spiritualistic things in the Bible. And
he was looking for an esoteric truth,
yes,
in something that is actually written as an absolute truth.
Yes, and so he told us not to go to church. He said they will lie to you. They will deceive you. But I had this longing to know what is in a church, because my friends were all Christian, and I thought to myself, now why is God locked up in a church? At one stage I went from church to church during the day, and I tried to find out what's in the church, but they were all locked.
How old were you?
I was probably about 10. Around there. And then everything was locked. And I said to myself, why is God locked up in a church? How good can he be to the world if he's up in there in a church? And so it just shows you how little knowledge I had about God. And then I found this little chapel. It was a little stone chapel that was open. And I actually went inside and I said, wow, this is, my life was hard. I had a tough life as a child. And yes, I'm a little bit emotional.
Now I know that you had a tough life. And I know the circumstances because you told me.
But yes,
it's a rather sad story, but you told the story without telling the story.
Yes.
Because you don't want to hurt people.
Yes.
So you tried to find refuge with a God that you didn't know.
Yes.
And all your classmates and all your school friends, they were all church going, but it was customary in South Africa for everybody to go to church.
Yes.
Of course you went to church. It was the thing to do, and you were the odd one out, so you were really in the minority, and you probably had some peer pressure.
Yes, there was a lot of peer pressure because my grandmother sent me a beautiful Bible. Now, she was very religious. And I took this Bible. It was a thick Bible with golden letters. And I took it to my teacher, and I showed her. And she said, yeah, it's nice. Whatever. So I put it in the desk, and after break, it was gone. Somebody had stolen it. And yes, whatever move I tried to make towards God was almost like there was a wall every time.
And I remember you told me that the pastors of the other churches, they were not exactly very open towards you because they knew what background you came from. They despised what your parents or your father stood for. And so instead of being inviting towards you, they treated you like dirt. Let's just put it that way.
Well, that was also part of the plan, I think, of God, so that we could meet, you and I, eventually.
Well, in actual fact, they treated you so badly, some of those pastors. They scolded you. You had to walk how many kilometers to go to church on Sunday, and the only one, because your parents wouldn't take you to church.
About more than 10 kilometers.
And you walked with what kind of shoes?
High-heeled shoes.
High-heeled shoes.
Not high, but just heeled shoes.
Heeled shoes. And you went to all that trouble, and then the pastor would treat you like dirt.
Well,
that's part of life, right?
Part of it. It's part of...
All right. Does that mean that Christianity doesn't have the truth because a pastor treats you like dirt?
No. It just helped for... so that I would search further. I wasn't, if I had stayed with that church, I would not have, probably not have discovered the truth. So God didn't allow me to stay there. I moved on, and we started searching later on.
Now, these friends that you had some very strange friends. The one was the daughter of the pastor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So... And then the other friends that you had came from a very dubious background where the parents were more into prostitution than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so you had this dichotomy. You had these hoi polloi friends, and then you had these very down-to-earth, trapped in an unsavory situation, friends.
I was always one for the underdog. I was always befriended the ones that were hurting, that were being trodden down. So that was...
And in school you were also trodden down, weren't you? But you were an excellent student, and the teachers loved you, and... all of those things. And I came from a background where I was the worst student ever, and everybody hated me and bashed me. It was the exact opposite.
My one problem that I had was because of my situation that I was in, which caused a lot of trauma. And it's very well known that a trauma can cause a person to to lose their ability to speak. And so I lost my ability to speak. And my father sent me to Scientology.
And the interesting thing is, through circumstances, we met, right? Because your brother and I were roommates at the university. Mm-hmm. And I had a stepmother where I wasn't very welcome at home. And so in university vacations, I normally worked and slept somewhere with a relative. I didn't go home. And if I did ever go home, my life was made so miserable that it was impossible to live under those circumstances. So on one occasion, your brother said to me, "What are you going to do?" And I said, "I don't know. I'm not going home. I don't know where to go." So he said, "Well, come with me." And so I popped up with your brother at your home, and I met you. How old were you when I met you the first time?
I was 15, and yeah.
I was 15, and I was already 21 or something like mm-hmm. that.
But when we actually had that trip to Mozambique, I was 17.
You were 17. That was 2 years later.
But that was an interesting trip because, again, I see God's hand in it. Because you had just broken up with your girlfriend.
Yes.
And my brother had his girlfriend. And so I was just asked to go along.
Now, the reason why I actually broke up with that girlfriend is actually quite interesting. Mm-hmm. Because she was quite pretty. And she won a beauty competition. She became Miss of a certain district in the country. And this, of course, brought a lot of attention her way. And her whole personality changed overnight. Mm. Is it possible that something like that, winning a beauty competition, can change your personality so that everything that you value falls apart? It's possible,
sure,
eh?
Sure. And we have to be careful.
So God wants a humble and a quiet spirit. And as soon as that humility disappears. So I couldn't live with that changed individual. It was very hard for me to accept that you can't live under those circumstances. You have no faith in a person being faithful, for example, especially if they revel in that situation. And under those circumstances, we were all planning to go on a trip to Mozambique, your brother and his girlfriend, and I was going to tag along because the one that was going to go with me was no longer going to go with me. And, you know, two is company, three is a crowd. What was I going to do there? It was a very uncomfortable situation. But we had already financed it, and I'd already promised. I had a car, so how were they going to do this if I didn't, you know, make it possible? And there you were. You were 17 years old. And we decided, okay, you can come along. And we went to a tropical island.
Yes.
It was the island of Magaruk. There was nothing on it, right?
It is the most beautiful. In those days, it was the most beautiful places to be in the Indian Ocean, off the coast of Mozambique. And there was nothing on this island. But on this island, I actually started to get to know you. And we were sitting on the beach, and you could just hear the waves, and you could hear the birds in the trees. And then suddenly you said something to me out of the blue. Can you remember what you said?
I said, "People are like stones."
Yes. So why did you say that? Surely the righteous shall give thanks unto thy name, the upright shall dwell in thy presence, and my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, and in sure dwellings, and in quiet resting places.
I'll tell you why I said people are like stones, because my whole life I kept all my troubles to myself. I had never opened up to anybody ever in my life.
So what made you suddenly open up?
I don't want to flatter you. You might be get a big head. But not even with this previous girlfriend. And it was a very serious case, that previous girlfriend. Mm. And not even to her had I ever opened up about why I was like I was, or why I ticked like I was, or like I was ticking. But I saw in you something that I'd never experienced before, like an empathy. And so maybe crack appeared.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I remember we talked almost through the night, sitting on that beach, and you told me a little bit about yourself, and I told you a little bit about myself. And some of the things were probably hard to believe, because if I told you about my relationship with my stepmother or anything like that, you always had such trust in people that you couldn't believe that people could actually be like that.
That is true. I was that person who always thought that everybody else is good, and I never understood that somebody could be so bad. And
and yet you experienced it in your own house.
Yes, but I mean, I was never ostracized or driven away from home like you were. And that's why, to me, that was strange, because in our home there was love and there was kindness.
Yes, I also looked at your home, and it was hard for me to realize that you were actually all in harmony, even though things were not going well behind the scenes. To the public eye, I had seldom met a family that was so open to a guest and so friendly. And I developed a very good relationship with your father, particularly, and your mother being the one who was the studious one. Your father was the romantic one. Mm-hmm. The one who was always searching for the unknown, but your mother was the academically inclined one, and she resonated with me because of my academic background. Yeah. And your father resonated with me because of my openness for anything that he had to say. So that was a totally new experience to me, to meet your family. But yes, I opened up a little bit, and I said people are like stones, because they really were. They grind you to pieces. And when they have destroyed you, they accuse you of being whatever they think you are, a weakling or a this or a that. So I became...
You became hardened.
I became harder than them in order to survive them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Inside you were hurting, and so the outside... On the outside, you became a harder person.
Yes, and I had a family that was very hard, that came from a very harsh background, some of them. On the one side of my family, you know, they were German. On the one side of my family, they were military officers in the Nazi army, and any sign of weakness or any tear that you had was immediately crushed as a sign of weakness. Boys don't cry, mm-hmm. So cowboys don't cry. That's the way I grew up. And so no matter how harsh the situation was, I would always hide the feelings and try to put a smile on my face because that's what was expected. Mm. And when I was at my mother's grave, I mean, I was a young boy, I was 12 years old. I tried to put on a brave smile. And did I get slammed for that brave little smile of being an unfeeling person that would dare to smile at the grave of his mother? I was the monster of monsters. And I was so misinterpreted that I became even harsher, and I never shared my feelings with anyone, except you.
Can you remember what you told me about your father and the piano lessons?
Yes, I remember what I told you about my father and the piano lessons. My mother tried to develop my softer attributes while she was still alive. I was very rebellious because she was very sick and I had all of these problems with the church and with the Catholic Church that told me that she was not going to go to heaven because of her faith. But she always tried to bring out the softer side, and so she sent me secretly to piano classes. And I would probably not be the greatest musician ever. I always say when I get to heaven one day, Gabriel will supply me with a triangle and tell me when to go ping. But when I had mastered my first musical piece, my father came home from work and she wanted to surprise him. And so she said, sit down. And she made me sit down at the piano and play this piece, and my father exploded as to how dare she make a boy go and
take music lessons
and become a sissy. No way was his son ever going to do music and become a sissy. And that was the end of my musical career from that day on. I was probably about 10 years old or something like that.
And yet you are very musical, you just don't know it. You have a good voice.
I don't know whether I'm musical. One day in heaven, maybe I'll pursue it, but now I will concentrate on other things. But I appreciated that you like music. Well, in any case, once you have opened up to a person, it creates a certain
bond,
and you had a certain background, which I don't think you shared with anybody ever, right?
No.
You never shared it with anybody. No. I think I'm the only one who really knows the whole story. And the whole story is not in the book.
No.
Because you cannot put it in a book.
No.
So, God takes those people, and I think he has compassion.
You're making me cry again.
Yeah, give me one too. Yeah, he has compassion. He's a good God.
You can keep it.
Keep it?
Thou, O Lord, art a God full of compassion and gracious, long-suffering and plenteous in mercy and truth. After Mozambique, you went back to university, and I went back home, and I finished my final year at school, and then...
And we corresponded.
Yes.
I wrote copious letters.
Yes, that's unusual for you.
Do you still have those letters?
No.
They're all gone, right?
Yes.
It's just as well that they're gone.
Well, I then decided to go to your university and the next year.
And that was far away, some 2,000 kilometers away from where you live.
Yes. And I arrived on the station. It was, I think, two trains. I had to take a train to one place and then another train to where you were at the university. And it was a 3-day trip.
Now, your parents never took you. Other parents made sure that their children arrived at their new locations, and you arrived all alone. That's the story of your life, right?
My parents believed that a child should grow up independently, so they didn't want to nurture us too much. And
got you into big trouble as a little girl, very often,
trouble,
right?
Yes. But so I arrive at the station in Stellenbosch, in the town where the university was, and you were supposed to meet me, and there was no one.
I dropped you like a hot potato.
Yes, I was only 17, and this is the first time I've ever been away from home. And then there was no one there, and I still struggled to speak. I couldn't speak to strange people because I had this impediment that developed because of trauma. And so I struggled, and eventually I phoned a taxi and they picked me up. And in those days, a dormitory was
like a boot camp.
Like a boot camp, so strict. You weren't allowed to do anything. There was initiation. You weren't allowed to leave the place. And then after 2 weeks of wondering what had happened to you, after 2 weeks, this strange little man came and he said that you're in hospital.
He was a very strange little man. I liked him a lot.
He was your friend.
He was a friend of mine. He was studying for a PhD at the university. And we were basically postgrad students together. I was already... teaching when you arrived as a very junior, sort of like almost like a bursary teacher. Mm-hmm. And this man was from New Zealand, and he was very strange. He was working on his PhD on chameleons. And when he would greet you, he would have these strange mannerisms. He would act and like a chameleon always. So if somebody was introduced to him, he would say, "How do you do?" Like a comedian. He was very funny. And he was also a perfectionist. Absolute perfectionist. So he would order his pens on his desk in a very particular sequence. And I was, of course, a terrorist. I loved to destroy his perfection. And so I developed a way of breaking into his office using a combination of keys and then just switching two pens around and then wait for the scream of disgust. And he would never find out who it was. And this strange little man is the one who came to you.
Mm-hmm. And he said, "You're in hospital." And then the matron, she said, "Go with him, but you come back straight away afterwards." And so there you were, lying there totally so sick because of malnutrition. You hadn't eaten properly. You didn't have enough money because your father disowned you at that point. And you got terrible infections, and you were just too weak to get up and come to the station to fetch me.
Yes. So at that stage, I had been disowned because of my stepmother, who said that he should not support someone like me. And at some stage, I took you to meet them.
Mm-hmm.
When I got back out of hospital, I took you to meet them. And she greeted you with the most horrendous words that I'd ever heard anyone say to anyone. And you still said to me, she can't be that bad. I think you're exaggerating. And the very first words that she said to you were so devastating. What did you do?
Yes, she said, she carried on and on about that you're going to inherit everything that she should be getting. And I was surprised, why say this? And then she said to me, I'm a little tramp or something like that.
A slut.
Something like that. And then I started crying because I've never been treated like that before.
No, she basically said to you that if you ever marry me, you will be inheriting what she should be inheriting. Yes. And therefore, by being a slut with me, you were going to inherit something and you couldn't handle it. And so you burst into tears, right?
Burst into tears. And then she said to me, I hope you cry for the rest of your life. And those words kept on coming back to me during my life, through my life.
I hope you cry for the rest of your life. Well, fortunately, the Bible says a curse given unrighteously does not delight.
Yes.
So had you known the Bible at that stage, you could have shaken it off.
I would have been comforted that no curse that any person or a demon or anything can put on you can affect you if you have Christ.
But I must tell you that the way that you are and your whole demeanor and your character, you totally won my father's heart.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was.
And as a result of you and me being together, his whole attitude towards me changed. Mm. And things became so much better. Mm. And then later on, we had to actually meet my father in secret without her knowing about it, so that if we should come through to the town where he lived, we would phone and we would arrange to meet somewhere in the foyer of a hotel or something like that, just so that she wouldn't know about it.
He was a sweet man. He was a hardworking German. And he obviously...
He was
just also
intimidated by her fury.
Mm.
Well, we finally did get married.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember it wasn't easy in the beginning because you were so timid and you couldn't speak when other people were present. And so I always knew exactly what you wanted to say or what you thought. And so when they asked you questions, I answered them.
Yeah.
And my colleagues and my friends, they always asked me, what's the matter with this girlfriend of yours? And why do you even stick to her? I mean, she doesn't speak and you always speak on her behalf. What's wrong with her? And I don't know how you handled that. How did you handle those academic friends, PhD students and all of them? How did you handle them?
I was terrified of them. they scared me and I couldn't even look at them. They were so arrogant and so hard. But yes.
So how did you eventually actually learn to speak?
Time. Time heals. Time heals scars. and things. But we got married and we started a family, and then things started from a very good, it used to be very good, our situation, and then it started to deteriorate. And you started to get a lot of stress at work, and the people started to be envious.
Yeah.
And you started to become dark, sort of not dark, but not even depressed, but that the old person I knew was not there anymore.
He shall call upon me, and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life will I satisfy him and show him my salvation.
What happened?
I don't know what happened. I guess the pressure of university, the pressure of being the blue-eyed boy now in the university setup, and striving towards getting better positions. And I was an atheist. There was no God to ever go to, and I guess life was just such that one develops a very hard shell.
Mm.
And when our first son was born, you remember that while you were pregnant, we were living in a house and all kinds of occult things happened, mm-hmm. that you explained in the story, in this haunted house. And finally, we moved from there back to Stellenbosch, because we'd left the town where you had studied and I had studied, because I got a job at another university. And then we came back, and then Martin was born. And at that stage, we lived in a derelict little farm cottage, which was a laborer's cottage. And it had cracks in it that you could put your entire arm through the wall. And the winters in the Cape were very harsh. And it was up in the mountains and everything was full of snow. And it was cold. And it's all that we could afford at that stage. Mm-hmm. And when he was born, you lost a lot of blood. And we found out that you really have a problem with the coagulation of your blood. You are what one would call a bleeder.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd lost so much blood, and there was nobody to help you. My stepmother would never have helped you. My father lived in another town. Your mother was 2,000 kilometers away. There was nobody to help us. And you fainted many times.
Yeah, right? Many times I would faint and then wake up 4 hours later on the floor and the baby screaming, hungry. And then I would feed the baby and then I would faint again and wake up a few hours later again. So.
And I had to be at the university. Yeah.
But at that time, it was a hard time for us because riots started. That was a very bad time, and we moved back to town, and because it was dangerous for me.
But then things got better financially eventually, and we moved from that into a little semi-detached house, and my father helped us at that stage again, so he had softened so that we could actually afford a little semi-detached house that we were paying off. And our daughter was born there. And then we moved to a new house. We sold that one and built a new one.
And then the third child was born.
And then the third child was born. And that was Robert. And
at that stage, my father was going through a divorce with my mother. And so he came to live with us. And that's when a lot of things happened as well.
A lot of occult things, which you describe in the book. If you dabble in occultism, then your life becomes darkness.
Yeah.
And there's no way out. You are trapped. Mm. So I actually feel sorry for people that are deeply involved in occultism. They have this constant feeling that they are moving to a higher plane, but they are trapped in something which takes all joy out of life. Mm-hmm. And you can see these people, people in very high circles moving in these occult environments, that eventually many of them commit suicide.
And especially at the university, the academic people are mostly non-Christian, and mostly they dabble in occultism.
Yes.
and spiritism.
Yes, I remember that one of the
lecturers
there, with which we were very well acquainted, mm-hmm. was actually a high priest in the Church of Satan.
Yes.
So these are actually realities that take place. And all of these occult things, I mean, what happened with Robert was just inexplicable. And you tell the story in the book, and how we eventually, through this, went back to the Roman Catholic Church to try and find some exorcism to relieve the problem. Now, it didn't go back to the church because you believed in God. You went back to the church because it was like going to the chemist, finding a cure for your pain, not because you wanted a relationship with God.
But isn't that so well planned by Satan to bring this calamity upon us, and then he brings the remedy, the Catholic Church? And
yes.
So
and then there's this peace and this quiet.
Yes.
And then your conscience starts working on you, and you say, well, you know, I'm an atheist. How do I deal with this situation? Is this fair to accept the cure without acknowledging the one who brought about the cure? Mm-hmm. So what do you do? And then that exorcist that we met, you don't mention his name, you change his name.
Yes.
In the book.
Yes.
And I went to drive to go and fetch him at the convent. And when I met him, he told me what was happening in my house, with me not having told him anything. That literally blew my socks off. That took the carpet right from underneath me.
And you thought that they have some power that you don't know of. It was like, it was drawing you in a way.
Yes, it was drawing me, because I have this up and down philosophy as a scientist. There must be cause and there must be effect and there must be laws of thermodynamics. And all of these things fell outside of those laws. Mm. And you couldn't deny the existence of the supernatural.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when we played Ouija board?
Yeah.
We built our own little Ouija board. Remember when we put our fingers on that glass and how it spelt out,
go to hell.
And what happened to the glass then?
Shut off.
It just shut off. And There was no way that we had anything to do with that.
Mm.
And the hairs on the back of your head go up and you think, what happened now? And then you realize that there's something supernatural. And from that day on, our life was hell.
Mm-hmm.
absolute hell because you had opened the door to a demonic presence in your house.
Yeah.
But you don't know that it's a demonic presence.
You don't know. You think it's you. In fact, we thought it was departed spirits. You wanted to speak to your mother. You had a longing to see your mother again, to speak to her. And so we thought this was a way to speak to her again.
Yes. So why did Satan actually step back and create a measure of peace? Why did he do that?
Because we were now where he wanted us, back to the Catholic Church.
There's a statement in the Spirit of Prophecy where she writes, Satan gives those that are chained to his chariot a measure of peace. But tug on the chain, and you will experience something that you never, ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
So what he wanted to do, I believe, was to settle us in the belief that the occult world and the church and all of them belong together. He doesn't mind if you are attached to the lie. Whatever that lie is, whether you believe in Satanism, whether you believe in good and bad spirits, white magic, black magic, he doesn't mind that. He doesn't mind if you are in a formal religion. He doesn't mind if you bow down your knee when the bell rings, when you say a chant, when the smoke goes. But if you have a personal relationship with God, that freaks him out.
And if you study the Bible.
If you study the Bible. What, do you remember what happened to Robert when we picked up the Bible?
Yes.
What happened?
Now, Robert was very restless as soon as we picked up the Bible to study, and then one day he broke a glass bottle and he walked all over it.
And he nearly severed his big toe, and we rushed off to hospital again to have his toe sewn on again.
Yes.
Always chaos when we picked up the Bible.
Surely he shall deliver thee from the snare of the fowler and from the noisome pestilence. He shall cover thee with his feathers, and under his wings shalt thou trust. His truth shall be thy shield and buckler. Thou shalt not be afraid for the terror by night, nor for the arrow that flieth by day, nor for the pestilence that walketh in darkness, nor for the destruction that wasteth at noonday. 1,000 shall fall at thy side, and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee.
Now, this Catholic priest, he was in his 70s, I would assume, right?
Probably.
Well, he was about 70. Mm-hmm. And he had this very calm demeanor.
Dignified.
Very dignified.
Mm-hmm.
He was Irish, an Irish Catholic priest, and he was the exorcist from the main cathedral. Now, the cathedral, of course, where the bishop has his seat. And he already had the papers signed by the bishop that he could do a mass in our house. That's amazing, eh? What did you feel when he came in? I mean, you weren't Catholic. You weren't really a believer. And here this man came in with all this turmoil in our house, this child screaming, this chaos.
Well, I thought, wow, this man is the Savior. He's going to save us from this situation, because he had such a calm way of doing it, and he knew everything ahead of time. What mortal being can do that? And so I saw him as a Savior who came to help us.
And when he said that mass and all the animals came running down?
Yes. I had great respect for him. And then he started to sway when he came into the child's room, and he started to look like he was going to fall. But
an unseen hand was plucking him around.
Yes.
It was all very dramatic, huh?
Very, very.
And I will never forget the dogs, two dogs and a cat.
But you didn't describe what happened. Why did he come to us? Why was he there?
Why was the priest there?
Yes.
Oh.
2 o'clock at night, what happened?
Yes, at 2 o'clock at night, I was being strangled. And at 2 o'clock at night, Robert would then, when I woke up, scream as though he was being murdered. And then he would develop these fevers and go into fever fits and pass out. And we thought he died. And we'd rush him to hospital in the middle of the night, and they would, for hours, try and revive him, mm-hmm. put him into cooling tents to keep his temperature down. It was such a nightmare, but people can read that in the book. Mm. And here was this man, and he was going to exorcise these demons that were causing this chaos. It was a supernatural situation. Every night exactly at 2 o'clock. Remember that red clock behind us on the bed?
Yes. And what happened to you every night at 2 o'clock?
Yes, I was strangled and I couldn't breathe, and I'd wake up and I'd be totally exhausted and bathed in sweat, and at that exact moment when I wake up, he would scream. And we were conditioned. I mean, it happened over and over and over again, and it wasn't natural, it was supernatural. And here was this priest. And with holy water and with a mass. But I still remember those two dogs, those two Rottweilers coming down that passage and then sit in that semicircle around this altar that he had built. And he took off his ring, remember, because mm-hmm. they had a relic in it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know you had to have a relic, a piece of a saint, so-called, in order to be able to say a mass, that it was actually a ritual for the dead. But somehow there was magical power in it, and from then on, the problem was gone. It was so peaceful in that house. Remember that night, when you put Robert to bed,
mm-hmm. what happened? On his back for the first time. He used to sleep like a fetus, curled up.
Screaming himself to sleep.
And then he was lying on his back and he was peaceful.
And he was googling, right? Mm. Making
Baby noises.
Yes.
But can you remember what happened at the priest phoned you? In the way that leads to the city of God, there are no difficulties which those who trust in Him may not overcome. There are no dangers which they may not escape. There is not a sorrow, not a grievance, not a human weakness for which He has not provided a remedy.